We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Blue Wire.
With the third pick in the 2020 NBA Draft, the Charlotte Hornets select LaMelo Ball from Chino Hills, California.
TJ, oh my goodness! Stunning with the left hand! Devontae deep! Oh my goodness! I don't believe it! A 30-footer to the diagram!
Just stop it already!
All right, what's going on? And welcome to another Buzz Beat. This is Richie, and today I'll be joined by James Herbert of CBSSports.com. I actually met James, if that's what you want to call it, through some Zoom media sessions with the Hornets, and I figured you must have been joining those sessions to do something related to LaMelo Ball, but you actually wrote an article on the team, which will actually be linked in the episode notes. You can actually go back and read his article. I think it's back in March. It was titled Inside the Hornets Nest. James, thanks for joining us, and how's it going?
Everything's going great. Thank you for having me, and thanks for plugging that story. That was definitely like the most fun I had writing about basketball this season.
And before we get into this, I want to ask, what's the meaning behind your Twitter handle, Outside the NBA?
Oh my God. Okay. So it is like a relic of the blog era. Like, I don't know. I guess I should check. I think I joined Twitter in like 2009, around there. I'll say it right in my bio. And like, that was just the name of my first blog. It was like, I could not call myself an NBA insider or anything at that point. I'd never covered anything. And I don't know. It was supposed to be like, yeah, there's Inside the NBA. Well, I'm outside the NBA. I'm just this like, I had some other, like some friends who wrote for my site too, but like, yeah, that's a relic of my very, very amateurish NBA thoughts from years ago that I hope nobody goes and tries to look up.
Well, I think everyone's going to do that now. Try to find that. So I didn't know, if it was random or if there was some kind of meaning behind it. So there, I guess there definitely is some meaning and some stories behind that. So in your article that I mentioned, you mentioned the Hornets being part of this Delete Eight and having that long layoff between their last game of the 2020 season and then 9 months later playing their first game of the 2021 season. I think a lot of people talk about the shortened offseason for the majority of the league that made the playoffs, but how difficult do you think it is for a team like Charlotte, who is, one, rebuilding, altering their offense, to not really have any kind of real organized basketball together for a long time? Because I think a lot of people would argue that the shortened offseason was very hard for some of these teams that made it to the playoffs, had an extended run in the playoffs. But I think an argument can also be made, you know, a team like Charlotte having these difficulties like that.
Yeah, I think it's really tough. I think just all that time without playing basketball was hard on guys. You know, like honestly, from like just a mental standpoint, like this is something that they had been done. I mean, just talking to some of the guys for that story, like Miles Bridges basically saying like he'd never gone more than like a week or two his entire life since he started playing basketball without playing basketball. And that was suddenly taken away. I mean, yeah, some guys could find gyms. It's sort of different people had different scenarios depending on where they lived and what was happening. And I mean, some guys, if you have a max contract, maybe you have a gym like in your house. I'm not sure that any of the Hornets had that. So I think at the time, it was frankly kind of terrible for a lot of people on those Delete Eight teams. I do think, though, that the mini camp mm-hmm. that these teams were all able to hold, like that then became super important, because that was training camp this year was super super short. It was rushed. There was all the testing involved. Some guys were arriving at slightly different times and they had to get cleared, and it was just kind of a mess. And at least for those teams, they had something else. Now, if you go and look team by team at everybody who's there, there's some differential between the roster they had on opening night versus who was actually at the mini camp. But I think for the returning Hornets, that was a big deal for them. That was one of the things I talked to Jay Triano about, just sort of in discussing the chemistry that the Hornets had this year, that I think was very apparent to anyone that followed the team. Is like, he stressed how much the chemistry grew when they were there. He compared it to, you know, when he was like coaching Team Canada and playing for Team Canada in international competition where there's nobody else around. It's just the team. It's just the staff and they're hanging out. And it's not like everybody just retreats and does their own thing. Like, there's a lot of kind of team bonding that happened there. And then also, oh, by the way, you get these competitive, basically pickup sessions with these pros who are all just like basically starving to go out and play after all these months of not being able to do that. So I think, you know, from a player development standpoint, it was probably helpful just to like get around the players again for the staff. But I think from a team building standpoint for at least this Hornets team, that was a big deal. And that at least helped to like give them something positive to latch onto, because as you said, like, that is not what you want. If you're developing a team, if you're like trying to build an identity, you have a whole bunch of young players, like, you don't want to just not see them for months and months and months on end and not get to test any of the stuff they're working on against NBA competition.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned their offseason in market bubble and how that could be beneficial with the team. But like you said, it was also before the NBA draft and free agency where they would acquire two of their biggest assets in Gordon Hayward and LaMelo Ball. But, you know, nonetheless, it was kind of like a consolation prize for them to at least have some kind of organized activities. And you know, maybe it was just like a bonding experience and kind of keeping that chemistry going. And I think that was one of the biggest things that we saw this year with the Hornets was that chemistry and players being able to play with multiple lineups, multiple players. It felt like that was a strength of the Hornets. Now, do you remember if you had any preseason predictions or expectations of this team? Because I think many were predicting this team to be one of the worst in the East.
Yeah, I thought their ceiling was kind of a play-in team, but I didn't know that they would get there. Like, I remember going on some podcasts and writing like sort of recappy stuff where, like, no, I wasn't super positive about the Hornets, but I was like kind of playing devil's advocate just because like everybody was kind of trashing them. And I was sort of like, well, look, like, this is what I think they're trying to do with the Hayward thing. Mm-hmm. And like, is it a lot of money to pay a guy who has like not been able to stay healthy since he signed in Boston? Like, yes. Like, is he on that same timeline as some of their younger guys? No, but this will organize the team on the court. This gives him another playmaker. I think he fits into like the style of basketball they want to play, blah, blah, blah. Like, ideally they improve a lot. They can sneak into the playoffs, make the play in, something like that. That was what I was thinking, like a best case scenario. And I think what happened was they exceeded everybody's expectations, right? And if they were able to stay healthy, I think they would have solidly been a playoff team rather than a team that was just trying to sneak in by getting through the play-in and whatever. And I think even if they had just been healthy in the play-in, they probably would have ended up managing to get in the playoffs, and then who knows what happens from there. But I think like the version of the Hornets we saw when they were at their best, mm-hmm, was like, I had a scenario in my head that I thought was like realistically possible. They would be decent, and they were better than decent. Like, they were a legit good team when they were healthy and like fully functional.
Yeah. From a national perspective, I think they exceeded everyone's expectations. I think from, you know, maybe a Hornets fan perspective or people that cover the team locally, you know, there might be some internal bias. I predicted them to be 11th overall in the East, which would be just outside that kind of play-in tournament. But like you mentioned, you know, when they were all healthy, they were way above that. I could have probably assumed they'd be a top five, top six team. Maybe that's debatable if they kind of kept their players all healthy. We'll really never know. I mean, we're not going to know that because they did not stay healthy. But, you know, this team just had so little room for error, right? Like, the talent top to bottom wasn't great, but they did have a good starting unit. And the players that did play, they were very impactful. From your point of view, from a positive note, I know this is a very wide open question. I'd love to know What do you think made this team play so well, especially when, you know, when all the players were healthy?
I think they were more than the sum of their parts from the very beginning. And I think you got a lot of player development in the roster. And then you just had like a team-wide sort of raising of the level that you got from basically because you added Gordon Hayward and LaMelo Ball in the same offseason. But it's like, it sounds simplistic to say that, like you add like a franchise level talent and it's like, you know, he's not playing like a superstar now, but he has that potential, right? And LaMelo and somebody who can elevate others around him. And then you also have a guy in Hayward that his numbers are pretty similar on a permanent basis, like what he was doing in Utah. And I think he was sort of perfect for the team because he is the kind of guy that even back then, like he was their all-star, he was their undisputed number one guy, but he was not just dominating the ball in every possession. He would allow other guys to make plays. And I think the fact that both LaMelo Ball and Gordon Hayward were playing at a high level individually, but no one seemed to care about whose team it was. Like, that is why this worked. Like, I had no idea going into this season how it was going to, how things were going to play out with those guys joining Terry and Devontae. And oh, by the way, Malik Monk is going to find a way to have this like bounce back season as well. Like, I couldn't have really conceived of all of that happening at the same time. The injuries probably had something to do with that, but I think it all just kind of worked. And then, you know, they got player development from Bridges. They discovered some things throughout the year. The fully healthy starting lineup with Zeller at center, they were like, what, like plus eight ish in non-garbage time minutes, I think. And then they did really well overall when they had Bridges at four and Washington at five, and they beat up on a lot of second units that way. And I think it was just a matter of them kind of figuring out who they were. It was a little rocky for the first couple of weeks of the season. And then they started to strengthen some wins together, and they played with such confidence. They knew exactly how they had to play. And I think it's having the main guys that know how to be a part of something bigger than themselves. And I think you have to credit Borrego and then the staff as well for what they were trying to instill.
Well, that's a good segue to this next question. I think an underrated aspect of this team's success was how well Borrego connected with his players and just his even keel kind of demeanor. Do you have any overall thoughts on him as a coach from the conversations you've had with him or the players, and or maybe just what you've seen out from him on the court?
He's so consistent and he's so positive. And I think that is so key for a young team. He is constantly preaching resilience, unselfishness, playing with the pass, that kind of 0.5 mentality he took with him from San Antonio about like, you get the ball, you can shoot past the dribble, but like do that quickly, put pressure on the defense. This is not a team that, I mean, I live in Brooklyn. I'm like going to watch the Nets later. And like, I actually shouldn't position it this way because the Nets have really tried to stress ball movement, like the cutting and all that stuff. They just killed the Bucks with that the other day. But like in general, like if they are matchup hunting and just running ISOs, like the other team is in a compromised position and they can just be doing just that. The Hornets, they are not a team like that. They have a bunch of playmakers, but they're not necessarily just like, all right, you go get me a bucket.
Yeah.
So they've had this mentality that it predated LaMelo and Gordon Hayward, and those guys fit into that. And I think the fact that Borrego was preaching this all along, the fact that he was always trying to build guys up and make them play with confidence, and he wanted them to play freely, which I think is important for a young team. Like I think that was a real source of just kind of steadiness for this team and allowed them to, you know, they had all these big comebacks. They had all sorts of clutch performance. They didn't play like a young team for most of the season. Things were a little bit different at the end, but for most of the year, you know, like I really thought that he had a lot to do with just kind of the overall character of the team.
Yeah. I think that, you know, in his first couple of years, he had to transition from Kemba Walker led offense to something a little bit different. And even when Kemba Walker was gone, those first couple of years, they were still pick and roll heavy. Like last year, Devontae Graham was the lead guard, point guard, running a lot of pick and rolls as a ball handler. That changed this year. Like he was shifted off ball a whole lot more, obviously with the addition of LaMelo. And to your point about the 0.5 mentality, there was just a lot of quick decision making and, you know, passing and getting it from one side of the court to the other, making the defense move. And I think that benefited a team that doesn't have a player, like you mentioned, that can go get you a basket if you need him to. I guess Gordon Hayward, but other than that, there's not really that many players on this team that can go out and get you a bucket. So it is going to be derived on a lot of this team ball movement. And Borrego hunted the right spots, or the spots that he wanted to hunt on the court, at the rim, from behind the arc. That's always been, I feel like, a positive of his, and his team definitely buys into that. With any guests...
I thought, like, the defensive philosophy and the offensive philosophy kind of, like, they made sense together, right? Like, he wanted to force turnovers and play really aggressive defense and get in passing lanes and get deflections and all this stuff, because he wanted to run. He wanted to play with pace. He wanted to play with energy. He wanted to take advantage of the fact he had a bunch of athletes. He had a bunch of guys that could do that. And I thought that really kind of, like, established itself pretty quickly. I mean, this was not a great defensive team, but it was a fun defensive team to watch for me throughout the year, especially early on when they were playing so much zone.
Yeah.
But I mean, they, regardless of whether they were playing zone and man, they were playing, like, quite aggressive defense. There was a lot of ball pressure. Like, there was a lot of sort of, like, we want to make the other team uncomfortable, and we want to cause turnovers. We want to run. We want to play fast. We do not want to get into this, like, grind it out slow game of, like, execution. And I think when they play games on their terms, they usually won. And it helps to then also have a guy like Hayward that can be a safety valve that, you know, when you're playing random basketball, if the first action doesn't work, you can go make something happen.
Yeah.
But I think he enjoyed playing this up and down style too.
Yeah, I think he knew that once when he got in the half court, a lot was going to rely on Hayward, or a lot was going to rely on, you know, trying to make the ball move from side to side, like I mentioned before. But, like, this team, I think prior to LaMelo's injury, and I have to look this up again, but I think prior to LaMelo's injury, they were number one in the NBA in terms of, like, points per possession in transition, in terms of, you know, when that did happen, they did score at a very, very high rate.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And speaking of LaMelo, I think I've got to ask every guest that joins here, what were your thoughts on him as a rookie? And number two, do you think he'll win Rookie of the Year, or do you think Anthony Edwards' kind of, you know, scoring outburst in the last 25 to 30 games of the season might sway some people?
I think he'll win it. I mean, personally, like, I didn't get a ballot, but, like, when I did my, like, fake ballot, like, I had Halliburton second and Edwards third. I framed it a little bit differently, but no, I mean, he was incredible. Like, I don't think anybody kind of could have predicted that he would translate his game quite this way. Like, a lot of the concern, I mean, you know, they've probably been over them a million times. Like, people were concerned that he was going to need the ball constantly, that everything was going to have to go through him. He was just going to do nothing off of the ball. He was going to be the worst defender in the NBA. He was going to take a lot of bad shots, whether they're deep pull-up threes for no reason or, like, forced contested floaters in traffic and all of this stuff, and, like, just kind of be apathetic about, like, team basketball and all of that. And it's just, like, he was the opposite of all of those things, man. Like, he was an awesome rebounder. He was a fantastic passer. He made everybody around him better. He moved without the ball. He didn't care about running a zillion pick and rolls. He cleaned up his shot selection, I thought, and he still took some bad ones, but it wasn't crazy. And defensively, like, he wasn't amazing, but he had absolute positive attributes on that end. I don't think when he was bad because of effort. Like, he tried, he got a ton of deflections. He tried to like pester and annoy opposing guards. He's like fairly versatile because he's just like, he's really big. And I think he was just kind of underrated and mislabeled in a whole bunch of ways. And the potential for him to improve some of those weaknesses that were correctly identified, which I think like those, there are some that exist, like, if he can iron out some of those like weaker points in his game, like he act like genuinely, I think can be a like superstar level player, like a franchise level player. Like the stats that he put up at his age, you can only really compare him to all stars and players that are better than all stars.
I think I had those same hesitations heading into the draft because he was not number one on my board. Not that I'm some kind of draft aficionado, but like, you know, the shot selection, his 3-point shot over in Australia was just not something that I could point to and be like, okay, this is something that's going to translate over to the NBA, because he shot 25% over there. And that just kind of worried me. And before his injury, he was shooting at a pretty high clip from behind the arc. And that was one of the biggest surprises to me. And then on the defensive side of the court, like you just mentioned, he might not have been the best player, but he competed, one. Number two, he had his length that allowed him to kind of catch up for those gaps and shoot the gaps and get steals and play into Borrego's transition offense. And the one thing that always surprises me with him is that like 15-foot floater. Like you see him just kind of, you know, put it up, and I'm just like, okay, this is not going in. And it actually went in more than I thought it would have. So I, like you, would have probably given LaMelo the nod for Rookie of the Year. Obviously, there's a little bit of bias that comes my way, but I think I would have Anthony Edwards second and then Halliburton third. But one person I think that has benefited a lot from the exposure of LaMelo Ball, not a player, but play-by-play announcer Eric Collins. You mentioned him in your article, but what are your thoughts on his like play-by-play style? Is it too over the top for you, or do you like that from a team guy?
I love him. Like, he's been my favorite analyst to watch this year. Like, I mean, or to listen to, I should say. It's such a perfect marriage of announcer and team, because like, he was like this pre-LaMelo. He will always be like this, no matter who is on this roster. I want to make that clear. That's something he also wanted to make clear. And when I talked to him, and I had to kind of assure him, like, no, like, I'm not trying to give LaMelo credit, like, for like what you do and who you are. Like, that is like 100,000% authentically him, and he is that guy. But to be able to hear him call like the LaMelo to Bridges alley-oops and all of the different like fast breaks and all the different, like, by the way, all the different game winners and clutch shots that have been hit by various Hornets. Cause it seems like pretty much everybody in the starting lineup had like at least one moment this year where they made some crazy play at the end of a game or something close to a game winner. And like, it was an absolute joy. And I love that he got all the coverage that he did. He was a pleasure to talk to when I interviewed him. And like, I mean, just, I don't know where he comes up with half the stuff. Like, it's it, like, one thing is like the excitement level, like that's obvious, but also like just his phrases. And it seems like he's just making all this stuff up on the fly. Some of them he reuses, obviously, like Humdiddly-Dee is like, if you're hearing that, something special has happened. But then other times I just feel like he's freestyling. And I just, I don't know, man. Like, I understand some people want the like straight ahead, straight laced announcer, but like, I dig that he, first of all, doesn't listen to any other announcers and has his own style, and that like he is unafraid to show the world how much fun he's having at work.
And to your point, like he has been this way since he has started. And I think with more people watching this team because of the fun style and LaMelo Ball and Miles Bridges, I think a lot of people are thinking that he's kind of putting it on just because they're having exciting plays and alley-oops and all that stuff. But that's truly not the case. Eric Collins has been this way since day one. And I personally enjoy it. I know that some people might be turned off by it, especially if you don't listen to him on a nightly basis. But I do enjoy Eric Collins a ton. I would love to get him on the podcast. So the season is over for Charlotte. Obviously, the playoffs are still going on, and the Hornets will have to shift their focus to the NBA draft, free agency, and I don't think they're going to get lucky again with the lottery. The lottery is going to be held on June 22nd. Let me get your opinion on this when it comes to draft philosophy. I think many people subscribe to the best player available theory. For a team like the Hornets, do you think they can be more selective in this year's draft, or are they going to be a team that's just locked into drafting the best player available, even if it happens to be a point guard or even if it happens to be a small forward, positions in which, you know, may not be high need right now?
I am generally a best player available guy. I think if it's close, then need should be the tiebreaker.
Right.
I think just based on where the Hornets are, though, it's like they don't have the number one pick. I don't think they're going to be in a position where they will be passing up somebody that is clearly like way better than the next guy. Like, it's probably going to be picking between a bunch of guys in the same tier. And at that point, then I'm pretty okay with them going into the draft and saying like, we're probably not getting a point guard
right?
because we probably don't need that. When it comes to wings, like, man, like, I don't think there's a single team in the NBA that I would look at and say they should not draft a wing because they have a really good one. Like, get as many of those dudes as you possibly can. To me, the only times where really you're like thinking about positions as a like big deal is when you have like a clear ball dominant point guard type deal and there's somebody else that fits that bill. Or if it's like a center type thing where I just think centers are not nearly as important as they used to be. And if you're not talking about a real transcendent superstar type, then you probably don't want to use a lottery pick on a guy like that, unless like it's a real glaring need and you think you found the perfect guy. That's kind of how I look at it from a philosophical standpoint. Like, if there is somebody who like is technically a point guard, but you think can play with LaMelo and can play with Terry and can play with, I mean, I don't know how much Devontae factors, like, I don't know how much Devontae or Malik factors in right now. I don't, like, we can get to that. But I think if you think the guy really fits how they want to play, sure. But if it's a close thing, I'm okay with a team like that being like, yeah, I'm going to do something a little different.
Yeah, that's the way I feel too. Like, it's typically BPA, but if there are two players that are kind of like neck and neck, I'm going to probably go position based or someone that fits the scheme a little bit better. But to your point, if they're drafting at number 11, the tier there or the drop off between one player and the next might not be that great. So you're going to probably shift towards someone that kind of fits your roster right now. Now, you mentioned Devontae and Monk. Both of them are free agents, and I don't think they're both going to be back with the Hornets. Do you, like, if you were in Mitch Kupchak's shoes, like, would you bring Devontae over Monk back, Monk over Devontae, let them both walk? Do you have a preference?
I mean, I think Devontae is the one I would probably try harder to keep. I think he'll probably get paid more, though. So it's difficult. Like, this is a tough job. I think you need to be thinking about role and fit and frankly, like, money. And if you make the calculation that your money is better spent bringing back Malik Monk, and that is like an easier thing to figure out, then you do that. I feel like the organization is probably quite invested in Devontae just because of sort of the story. And a lot of times when you have a homegrown guy like that, when you kind of plucked him out of obscurity and developed him, like, that is where you can also get in trouble, because front offices get wedded to those players and they end up overpaying them. So I'm a little bit cautious about the whole thing. And Devontae, I think, is the better player, but you're asking me a question that sort of depends on the market. And I don't know what kind of offer sheets are going to be out there for those players. So it's hard for me to confidently like make a prediction of what will happen.
Right. I've had this debate with Brian and Spencer, my other two co-hosts, like throughout the course of the season. One week I'm saying Malik Monk. The next week I'm saying Devontae. You think it might be easier to bring back you might think it'd be easier to bring back Monk versus Devontae, but it feels like the front office and James Borrego has had like this little bit of a divide with Monk. They've always said that, or Mitch has said multiple occasions, that Malik Monk is the most talented player on this roster, but in his tenure in Charlotte, he has had this up and down minutes rotation with JB. Yeah. And it just feels like, I don't know if JB doesn't trust Monk or JB doesn't feel like Monk fits perfectly within to what he wants to do. So I almost feel like Monk won't be coming back, regardless if it's easier or not to bring him back. He does have a $16 million cap hold right now with the Hornets. So that makes things a little bit difficult if you don't renounce him, to have that kind of tied up on your books. But yeah, to me,
that is a good point. Yeah. Cause I was thinking more like easier as in, I think he will command a smaller contract, but if we're talking about cap holds and flexibility, then one easy thing they can do is say bye-bye Malik.
Right, right. I mean, to me, they're neck and neck. You could make an argument for Devontae. You can make an argument for Monk. They both offer something a little bit different. I kind of have a soft spot for Devontae, but again, you can make the argument that Monk is a better, well-rounded player too. So it's really kind of personal preference. And moving into free agency, a kind of last off-season question here for you, James. Obviously, the most glaring need is the center position. Two-part question. What did you make of Zeller and Biombo this year? And then number two, do you have any centers on your mind that would be a good fit for Charlotte?
Yeah, I think I was not always super clear on... I was sometimes confused about what was happening with the center rotation, as I think a lot of people were. I got usually, like, if Biombo was starting and playing big minutes, it was because Borrego felt like they needed better defense and they weren't getting the stops they needed. Like, I basically understood the rationale. I think most of the time, if I was like confused, or if I was a little like, maybe I disagree a little, it was probably because I thought Zeller should have been playing. And that is like, I have some affection for Bismack Biombo. I live in Brooklyn now. I used to live in Toronto, and I covered the best year of his career by far. And I don't know how much, like, I mean, I do know, like, you would have dealt with him. He is a pleasure to talk to. He's a great guy. I think, like, based on everything that I, like, everything people told me when I was reporting the Hornets story, like, he's been absolutely incredible for that team's chemistry and, like, for LaMelo specifically. So I don't really have a bad thing to say about him from that perspective. But I just think, like, there were times when this team would have these lulls offensively, and a lot of that, the time that was coinciding with when Biombo was getting big minutes and on the court. And it was just like, I know it doesn't really matter. Like, it's not worse to like miss a decent look than it is to like have a would-be dunk or layup kind of like go off his fingertips. Like, you're not scoring either way, but it felt like it was more than just 2 points that you were losing when those possessions happened. And when those possessions happened at the end of a close game or a big game later in the season, that was like a little bit frustrating for me. So that's sort of how I felt about the center rotation. I did like, I should say about Zeller, like, I understand the defensive concerns. I understand, like, he never became the, like, stretch guy that he was trying to be and all of that either. But I did like, we saw a little bit of growth, I think, in terms of, like, his, like, high post passing. Like, saw some, like, good, like, high-low stuff with him. They tried to use him, like, a little bit more as a playmaker this year, which I didn't really know if he totally had that in him. So I liked that deal. But, like, clearly, the Hornets would like, I think, somebody who can, like, be more of a threat with the ball in their hands in that position, who can make plays out of the short roll, who can stretch the floor a little bit without having to go small and put PJ there. And I mean, I kind of have like a long list of bigs that are available and sort of like non-bigs that can kind of functionally do the same thing. Right. Like, I mean, I live in Brooklyn, as I said, and like Bruce Brown, a restricted free agent, Blake Griffin and Jeff Green are not really centers, but they're all free agents this summer. But yeah, I mean, the bigger names, like, I don't know if you can pry Jared Allen away from Cleveland. When you make a trade for a guy like that, you probably intend to pay him whatever he kind of wants. John Collins is in a little bit more of a murky situation, has been linked to Charlotte forever, but I mean, he's a big part of a really good team that, I mean, hell, might make the conference finals now. So
he surprised me this playoffs, James. He has surprised me with his corner three shooting. And, you know, I didn't know that was a part of his game. And, you know, they always talk about his defense not being, you know, top tier, which is obviously what Hornets need to kind of focus on this offseason, is getting some players that have two-way ability. But John Collins, improved. Yeah, he has. But he's impressed me this postseason, I should say. And I don't know if I would, you know, go after him per se, but he's kind of made me do a double take this offseason, or this post. God, I keep saying offseason, this postseason.
Yeah, I mean, for the Hornets, it's the offseason. It's All right. But I think those guys would, like, fit. I think Rashawn Holmes would fit on any team. And there's, like, he's, like, the favorite of basically any, like, fan base who has, like, money to spend and needs a five, I think, for good reason. And then, like, once you get past those guys, it's like, I don't know what to make of Zach Collins anymore. And he's a restricted free agent. I don't know what the hell the Blazers are going to do. And then if you want to talk about like some veterans and dudes that can like just kind of step in and be productive and might not be like part of the core, like, you know, like Nerlens is a free agent. Like, you've got like Kelly Olynyk, who is like killing it in Houston at the end of the year and would give the Hornets exactly none of what they need defensively, but oh man, he would fit offensively in this system. You know, Tice is a free agent. Like you could take a flyer on like a DJ Wilson or like a, if you, I don't know that you can pry Juan Toscano-Anderson away from Steve Kerr's loving embrace, but I like him as a small ball five, and he would make sense. But yeah, there's like, it depends where, what you are looking for. Are you looking for somebody, like, are you renouncing everybody and you're going to spend your cap space on one guy, and this is going to be like the sort of final piece of the rebuild? Then I think we're talking about a very, very small list of guys. And it honestly might just be Jared Allen and John Collins that really fit that bill. And then beyond that, there's, you've got the Holmeses of the world, and yeah, Zach Collins is kind of a question mark. And then other than that, we're sort of talking about veteran role players.
Yeah. I like Holmes the best. I was actually kind of pushing for a trade for Holmes at the deadline for Charlotte, but mm-hmm. it probably made more sense to, or, you know, it's smarter just to wait until free agency. He's a good two-way center. I think that would be just a perfect target for Charlotte, but he's obviously going to garner a lot of money, I would think. Nerlens Noel, you mentioned, he's a little bit more limited offensively, but he can still be a roll and lob threat. To me, like, he is somebody that the Hornets would need on the back end, just being that rim protector. That's something that the Hornets have lacked. And I think that James Borrego this season, at certain times, they have outperformed on the defensive side of the court. But I think the reason maybe, James, that they played zone defense was to kind of simulate, you know, a yep. rim protector and pack the paint. But yep. once when you have a player like Nerlens Noel, you know, you can get away from the zone and just use zone when you need it every so often. And then you also mentioned Daniel Theis. I think he's an underrated name. I really do. I think he's a scrappy player, good screen setter. In a way, he reminds me of Cody Zeller, in a way. I'm sure fans would want something a little bit different than him and Zeller, so they might be a little bit underwhelmed by that signing. But I actually think that would be a decent signing, just probably not my top preference. But I would not be upset if Theis was the pick there.
I mean, we have seen Theis play a big starting role on a really good team before. He ran up into a buzzsaw and Bam Adebayo in last year's playoffs. But like, other than that, like, there weren't a ton of matchups that he struggled with. And this is a guy, he's really like, he's like 6'8". He's not like this big, strong guy, but he just battles really hard. He sets monster screens. He can space the floor a little bit. He's not like a true stretch five that wants to take 6-7 threes a game, but he can make them if you're daring him to. He can make the mid-range shot. And I think he's just like a smart player. He's mm-hmm. particularly a smart defensive player and a smart screener, and can be a guy that like sops up minutes at relatively low cost for a playoff team, which is what the Hornets intend to be. So I think, yeah, like one other thing, like with both Theis and Noel, like I think Nerlens is like a little bit more mobile, but I mean, Theis is more mobile than he looks. You can play pretty much any type of defense with those guys. Like right. if you want to like put Nerlens in a switch everything defense, you can absolutely do that. If you want him to play up at the level, you can do that. If you just want him sitting back in the paint and being your traditional rim protector in a drop coverage, which is like mostly what he's done with the Knicks. Like, I mean, we've seen him be very effective in that role too. And he gets a ton of deflection, which I mean, Charlotte likes to do that. I think you've identified guys like, I mean, Holmes is kind of similar in that way. Right. And like Holmes, I think is just a better offensive player. It's funny, like the Sixers used to have both of those guys and now they have developed into, you know, similar type of guys. But I think if you were kind of anticipating where they'd be at this point, you would think Nerlens would sort of be at the level where Holmes now is. I think he is more coveted and seen as the more like higher upside play than Nerlens. It's a little weird.
Yeah, the Hornets can have up to like $27 million in cap, but that's if they renounce all their free agents and all that stuff. Yes. That just isn't very likely. It'll probably come in closer to about $20 million and then kind of work their way from there. So we're going to end with some rapid-fire questions. Most of them deal with the Charlotte Hornets, but a couple of them deal with the national level here. Don't think too hard about these. I promise I won't hold you to this, okay? Number one.
Okay.
First player you think of, past or present, when I mention the Charlotte Hornets is blank.
Muggsy Bogues.
Okay. Number two, first player you think of, past or present, when I mention the Charlotte Bobcats.
Gerald Wallace.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's probably a common
I want to say, I want to change it to Byron Mullins, but it is literally Gerald Wallace, but I want my answer on the record to be Byron Mullins.
All right. Number three, true or false, Charlotte Hornets have the best color combo in the league.
Yeah, true.
And true or false, here's kind of like a hot take. Phoenix Suns will make the NBA Finals.
Whoa. False, because I actually picked the Nuggets in this year.
Okay. And then number five, your 2021 NBA champion is blank.
Brooklyn.
Yeah, I think I lean that way too. Yeah, it's if they can get it out of this Bucks series, I think they're gonna win it all as well. So I don't know if are you a homer because you're in Brooklyn, or you just feel that way.
I mean, it'd be nice to walk to the games, the NBA Finals, but no, that's not why. Like,
yeah,
I just look, the odds just decreased significantly because I don't know if we're going to see James Harden play again. But I mean, if he's back and if they're themselves, like, I just don't know what you do with this team.
Yeah. All right, guys, as we wrap here, I first want to let you guys know that Brian and Spencer will be releasing a pod later this week. We wanted to remind you, as always, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. If you submit one that is clever or one that we'd really enjoy, we will read it on an upcoming episode. Also, the CBS Sports article from James that we reference will also be in the notes. James, as we sign off here, I'll give you the floor to promote you on your social media and anything you've got going on in the future.
Well, as we discussed earlier, outside the NBA on Twitter, I should honestly change that. I've been meaning to forever. And all my stories go up in the NBA section, cbssports.com. And yeah, I mean, if you missed the Hornets piece, please read that. You don't have to read anything else. If you read that, I'll be thrilled.
Are you a big college prospect guy? Do you get into the draft at all?
Not as much as I used to.
Yeah.
But around draft time, I get really into it. I just, it's hard for me to watch as much like NCAA as I did when I was younger.
Yeah. I'm going to have to start doing that, start diving into some college prospect research. So if any of our listeners have any prospects that are kind of in that Hornets range around 11, please send them to me on Twitter. I will talk to you guys later. For James, I am Richie. We will see you guys next time.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers. The trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.